Rachel, my awareness of your work came about as a result of reading what you wrote about the passing of Ben Bradley, and I was fascinated that you hail from Cairo and that you are in the public radio world and that you're doing very interesting work. Where shall we start?
I could start with talking about growing up in southern Illinois in Cairo. I am the ninth of 10 kids. My father was a laborer. He worked at the mill, and my mother was a housekeeper for many years for a wealthy family across the main street, as usually happens in those cases. But, you know, she was someone who was very much interested and supportive of education, and even though some of her life dreams were constricted by marriage, kids, whatever, she was truly determined that her daughters, and all our kids really, but certainly that her daughters would be able to be educated and get out into the world and see the world beyond Cairo. So I think of all 10 of her kids, I guess I must have taken it most, that advice most to heart, because I have been spending so much time living abroad. I have to admit that a lot of my life's journey has been a combination of intention, sort of, you know, wanting to do good work or do something that made a difference, and a heck of a lot of serendipity. And I think the example that I used to write the Ben Bradley tribute was an example of that, because I had left school. I had initially entered Northwestern University in 1979 and left after 1 year, returned to Southern Illinois University Carbondale in a class, freshman English class, and wrote a piece about Black English and why, even though I feel it's part of my history and something that I'm comfortable using and identifying with, I realized very early that you have to have a mastery of standard English to succeed in American society. A teacher or an instructor said, it's good enough to be published. You should try to get it published. Send it off to Newsweek on a Friday. The following Tuesday, they said they want to use it. The following Monday, it was in the magazine. And a month later, I'm getting letters and calls, and I hear from, one of those letters was from Ben Bradley. We could talk for an hour about all of the kind of serendipitous things that have happened to me from that moment to where I sit now in a Voice of America news bureau in Nairobi, Kenya. But I'll just say, to answer at least that first question, is that's where kind of where it began, right there in your neck of the woods.
It's an example of using intelligence and your world and being honest about it and communicating it well and having people perk up and listen to you. So congratulations.
Absolutely. Absolutely. You know, and I think that's the thing that has moved me and impress me, or however you want to put it, most about the response to this piece, is that I truly would characterize the response as 90% positive and almost overwhelmingly so, and then 10% of people who just really couldn't get beyond the headline, which was how Ben Bradley's outrageous use of white privilege changed my life. And I think those who were offended or whatever saw the word white in the headline and saw that my skin was brown and automatically shut down and assumed that it was a negative piece and that it was another minority whining about, you know, not having access or not getting something, when it was truly based exactly on what you just said, which is my skill or my ability to use satire or a snark or whatever you want to call it was a tool that through my writing skill and my writing experience through the years, I was able to use to get people to read it. And so that majority of people who got it and who took the time to read the piece and who felt that I was being sincere and honoring this man, it just almost shocked me. It blew me away, the extent to which people got it.
Well, again, I guess it's the clarity of your voice, and I'd like to fast forward to the future, to the present, if you will, and obviously Ebola's on everybody's mind over here. What's it like in Nairobi? What part of culture is Ebola playing now there?
Well, lately, anyway, I'm thinking of an infographic that I saw on Facebook and instantly shared, and hopefully it's getting around. It's a picture of the African continent. The three countries that have been hit by Ebola are in West Africa, and so they're colored red, green, and blue, I think. And then the rest of the continent is just a tan color, and it has the word not Ebola. So an arrow pointing to those three countries saying Ebola is here, and then the rest of the continent, not Ebola. It's probably less of an issue here in Kenya than it is in America, because there are no cases of Ebola in East Africa. There are no cases of Ebola in South Africa. Well, there are a few perhaps in Central African Republic, because that was an epicenter a decade ago, and there may be some remaining cases. Because it's something that's happening on the African continent, and more than anything else, because the issue has laid bare the failings of many African countries to fund healthcare and fund their infrastructure and fund education, that then it's certainly something that's on people's minds in Kenya on one level. But on another level, there is no Ebola in Kenya. There's no fear right now anyway, until a case does occur. But again, in America, you've had two or three, or at least two confirmed, and lots of fears. So
what are the projects you're working on? They are health-related.
For the past prior 6 years in Kenya, I came to Kenya in July of 2008, originally on a grant from the Gates Foundation, and it was to mentor and train journalists who want to cover health. So for the first 5 years, certainly in Kenya, that was my primary focus of educating journalists about health care, access to care, funding, you know, how to report on health issues. Now, my scope has expanded to include development writ large, and so I also include agriculture and food security and sanitation, et cetera. But specifically, at the moment, I am an editor of a Voice of America program called South Sudan in Focus, and so from Nairobi, I edit reporters in South Sudan who are covering the ongoing conflict right now and just development issues in South Sudan.
It sounds like you have a very interesting life. Tell me what you like best about living in Nairobi.
I think the absolutely staggering mix of people that come in and out of here. There's an upside and a downside. Having been here 6 years myself, have made and lost, if you will, close friendships with people who have cycled in and out. So a lot of people are here on 1 year, 2 year, maybe 3 year at the max stints. And so if you wind up staying 6, 10, whatever years, people come in and out of your life. But it's just a fascinating array of people from all around the world, lots of different perspectives and different lifestyles and things that a little girl from Cairo, Illinois would not have been able to conceive. All those years ago, I'm getting to live that. So I think that's probably the best thing about it.
What are next steps for you?
Well, eventually I want to come back home. And I tell people here lately, I missed living in America during the tenure of an African-American president. I'm determined to be there when a woman is president. So let's just say that the interim plan is to head back in that direction within a few years.
Was Cairo dying when you were growing up?
Yes. You know, I was born in 61, so the integration situation was reaching its height towards the end of the 60s, and people were fleeing. And so the population when I was young was probably maybe 10 at its highest, 15,000. Now it's probably down to no more than 3,000, to be generous, if that. So, it was starting the downhill slide when I was growing up.
Did you have any experiences that one would assume one might have in that situation?
Well, yeah. Again, being the ninth of 10 children, my parents were Jehovah's Witnesses. So not only were we, forced to talk proper and get our education and not party and not hang out and do whatever, there was just a whole lot of separateness that was a part of growing up during that period. Also, of course, the civil rights movement. And Cairo, I tell people that in the 1870s, Dickens referred to Cairo as a fetid swamp during one of his tours. But Martin Luther King, during the 60s, called Cairo the Birmingham of the North. So, you know, if he felt it was that bad, things had to be pretty bad. So many of my older brothers and sisters experienced that racial segregation or the issues related to that firsthand, and I watched them experiencing it. One of my earliest memories in Cairo, there was this group called the White Hats, which was Cairo's version of the Klan, I guess. And they would ride through black neighborhoods just shooting, obviously trying to scare people. But we had this big clawfoot cast iron tub that in one of the houses that we lived in. And my mother would tell us that if you ever hear anything that sounded like firecrackers or gunshots, that we should all jump into that tub. So, yeah, I mean, again, there's a million of them. We could talk for an hour about some of my memories of Cairo in that regard. But it ironically fueled my desire to write about and to help people understand issues of race and poverty, et cetera.
Do your siblings still live there?
I have one brother, John, who lives there.
Well, at least you have one anchor to home.
Yes, and my brother-in-law, Ronald Newell, I'll give him a shout-out, still lives in Cairo. And so he is just as much a brother to me as the others. So he's one of the folks I'll be going back to visit.
You'll have to drop by WKMS.
I am planning and I'm thinking about trying to get back in January. So I may just take you up on that.
All right. Thank you so much.
You're very welcome.